The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the double November-December 2021 issue. We begin with our feature story, Cruel Inventions. The War of the Currents between Edison and Tesla is one of history's most famous rivalries. Edison's desperate bid to win took him to a shockingly dark place. The crowd in the auditorium had no idea what they were about to witness, but the appearance of the dog put them instantly on guard. It was July 1888 at Columbia College in New York, and an electrician named Harold Brown had dragged a 76-pound Newfoundland mix on stage and forced it into a wooden cage surrounded by wire mesh. While the dog cowered, Brown read a paper about the merits of alternating current, or AC, versus direct current, or DC, with an emphasis on how alternating current was deadlier. Upon finishing, he proceeded to do what everyone present feared, wrapping wet cotton around the dog's right forelimb and left hind limb, then wrapping the cotton with bare copper wire. The wire was connected to a generator, and when everything was ready, Brown flipped the switch. After each pulse, some AC, some DC, the dog howled and quaked, and once slammed so hard against the cage that its head ripped through the wire mesh. Eventually, after an AC pulse, it died. One witness said the demonstration made a bullfight look like a petting zoo. Brown, meanwhile, was elated. He felt he had proved his main point, that AC was deadlier than DC, since AC had killed. He knew this would be music to the ears of his benefactor, too, the man who had sponsored the torture of the Newfoundland, as well as several other animals, that American saint, Thomas Edison. We all know the story. Despite less than 3 months of formal schooling, Thomas Alva Edison, through a mixture of gumption and genius, helped invent, or at least develop, dozens of innovative technologies, stock tickers, vote recorders, movie cameras, fire alarms, and more. And while Edison didn't invent the light bulb, he and his team of tinkerers did turn a dim, fragile, expensive fire hazard into a cheap, reliable device capable of illuminating the world. That said, Edison could be a real bastard sometimes. He and his assistants put all grueling hours in, regularly working past midnight and sleeping in closets at the lab. But Edison alone hogged the glory for his inventions. He was a backstabbing businessman, too. Many people agreed with one executive who sneered that Edison had a vacuum where his conscience ought to be. In the 1880s, Edison came up with his killer idea, wiring cities for electricity. Even at the time, the residents of most big cities walked around beneath a cat's cradle of wires strung overhead. These were mostly telegraph and arc lighting wires, specialized for one purpose and restricted to certain businesses. Edison proposed threading electrical wires into everyone's business and even into people's homes. What's more, Edison's wires wouldn't be restricted to one purpose, but would supply power for everything. Motors, looms, light bulbs, you name it. He understood, as few contemporaries did, just how revolutionary electricity could be, and he wanted to be the man to power America. It was a grand vision, but scientists with delusions of grandeur like this often fall for the means-end fallacy. They convince themselves that their research will usher in a scientific utopia, and that the bliss of that utopia will supersede, by many orders of magnitude, any suffering they're causing in the short term. That is certainly the stance that Edison took with electricity and animals. However, as history shows, when we sacrifice morals for scientific progress, we often end up with neither. There was one big problem with Edison's plan to wire cities. His patents relied on direct current. Direct current is like a river, a flow of electrons in one direction only. Alternating current, in contrast, is like a fast tide. The electrons flow first one way, then another, alternating direction dozens of times per second. The problem with direct current was that DC power lines, which carry the electricity from power plants into homes and factories, needed fat, expensive copper wires, while AC systems didn't. As a bonus, thanks to higher electrical voltage, AC systems didn't need to have power plants every few blocks. A single plant could serve a whole city. All these factors put Edison's plan to wire cities with DC at a big disadvantage. Still, alternating current back then did have one major downside: poor equipment. Unlike with DC, no Edisons had invested their time and genius in making good, reliable AC motors, generators, and transmission gear. As a result, Edison believed that his superior machinery, coupled with his glittering public reputation, would overcome the high cost of plant construction and copper wires and give him a decisive edge in the marketplace. It all might have worked out that way, too, if not for a young Serbian immigrant named Nikola Tesla. After studying electrical engineering in Europe, the 28-year-old Tesla traveled to the United States in 1884. He arrived with 4 cents, a book of poems, and a glowing letter recommending him to Edison. Impressed, the 37-year-old Edison hired Tesla as an engineer, but the two clashed over scientific differences. Edison favored DC, while Tesla believed the future belonged to AC. After quitting the job, Tesla landed with entrepreneur George Westinghouse, who was investing heavily in AC technology. For Edison, what historians now call the War of the Currents was only partly about money. Yes, he wanted to fund his beloved research lab, but he had also made his reputation as an electrical wizard, and the thought of being bested in this arena enraged him and threatened his scientific ego. Losing would threaten not only his bank account, but his sense of self. The danger was personal. He therefore began slandering AC power in newspapers, claiming it would kill people left and right. And Edison soon decided that smears weren't enough. He needed to show people the dangers of AC, make them cringe. In short, in a dog-eat-dog world, he decided the best way to get ahead would be to kill some actual dogs. Brown, who led the demonstration at Columbia, was an electrician who more or less worshipped Edison, going so far as to write an incendiary letter to a newspaper denouncing AC. But his diatribe was criticized by several engineers, who maintained that he had too little evidence to support his claims about the dangers of AC. So, despite having never met Edison, Brown wrote and asked whether he could use the labs there to generate more evidence by helping Edison electrocute dogs. To Brown's surprise, Edison agreed. In truth, opening up his lab to strangers wasn't unusual for Edison, who could be quite generous at times. In this case, he even loaned Brown his top assistant to help out. What was unusual here were the conditions Edison put on the work. Normally, Edison encouraged collegiality and the open exchange of ideas, the scientific ideal, but he told Brown to keep mum about these experiments. He also restricted Brown to working at night so that people wouldn't hear the howls. Someone posted a sign near Edison's lab offering a quarter apiece for stray dogs, and local ruffians came through by capturing them in droves. Brown planned to electrocute the mutt systematically, but in reality, the work was haphazard. The dogs differed wildly in size: setters, terriers, St. Bernards, bulldogs, and he zapped them with both DC and AC at anywhere from 300 to 1400 volts. The results were nevertheless consistent: an uninterrupted litany of suffering. After a month of this, Brown felt confident enough to arrange for the demonstration described above, where he tormented a Newfoundland mix at Columbia. The newspaper coverage was outraged, and any normal man would have slunk away in shame. Brown, in contrast, staged another demo a few days later, killing 3 more dogs with alternating current and allowing doctors to dissect them afterwards. All in all, he reported to Edison's assistant, the experiments were a fine exhibit about the dangers of AC. Others disagreed. Not only was Brown being cruel, they argued, but his experiments proved nothing. In shocking some of the dogs with DC first, he had battered and weakened them, making it impossible to determine how much of each type of current they had contributed to their deaths. Furthermore, dogs were small animals. If humans were shocked with AC, there was no guarantee that they would react the same way. In response to these criticisms, Brown held yet another demonstration in December 1888 at Edison's lab. This time, he electrocuted big animals and used AC alone to do so. He started with a 124-pound calf, attaching an electrode between its eyes. 770 volts dropped it. Eventually, Edison's team would kill 44 dogs, 6 calves, and 2 horses in their quest to discredit alternating current. But none of these deaths did any good. Westinghouse continued to crush Edison in the marketplace. By the end of 1888, Edison's company was building and selling enough equipment to power 44,000 light bulbs per year. Westinghouse sold enough equipment to power 48,000 light bulbs in October 1888 alone. Edison eventually conceded defeat in the War of the Currents. Few people in history can match his record of innovations, but his beloved direct current played almost no role in the 20th century revolution in cheap electric power transmission. The real shame was that he didn't bow out with grace and spare those horses, calves, and dogs the pain and indignity of electrocution. It might be tempting to excuse Edison and Brown's behavior on the grounds that theirs was a different era, a time when society simply didn't treat animals well. But many people back then, such as Voltaire and Samuel Johnson, did protest cruel scientific research and had been doing so long before Edison's day. Conditions have clearly improved since Edison's time, but experiments involving animals remain controversial today, even among some scientists. This is partly due to the sheer number of animals that die. Medical research exploded in the second half of the 20th century, and by the year 2000, American scientists alone were going through 500 million mice, rats, and birds per year, plus dogs, cats, and monkeys on top of that. The scale is staggering. The obvious rejoinder is that animal research saves human lives through the development of drugs and other treatments. While that's certainly true, there are caveats. However useful animal research was in the past, it often falls short of expectations nowadays. One survey of 26 known human carcinogens found that fewer than half also cause cancer in rodents. You might as well flip a coin to get the same result. Things are even worse with new medicines. In 2007, the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services admitted that 9 out of 10 experimental drugs fail in clinical studies because we cannot accurately predict how they will behave in people based on laboratory and animal studies. Such failures are in fact so common, they're almost cliche. How many times have we heard about some amazing therapy that miraculously stops cancer or Alzheimer's disease in mice, only to watch it flop in human beings? Perhaps this shouldn't surprise us. Evolutionarily, rodents and humans diverged 70 million years ago, back when dinosaurs still ruled the Earth, and we have notably different physiologies. Penicillin is actually fatal to that proverbial lab animal, the guinea pig. Had scientists initially tested this drug on them, it never would have made it to market. Given these facts, some critics of animal testing have been scathing. One called animal research an internally self-consistent universe with little contact with medical reality. In the past few decades, there's been a movement to cut back on the number of animals used in labs and find alternatives. Possible alternatives include running tests on human organs grown in dishes, called organoids, or using computer programs to estimate the efficacy of new chemicals by comparing them to known compounds. In all, life is vastly better for research animals today compared to the 1880s, but reports of abuse still pop up in labs around the world, And outre experiments like monkey head transplants have not ceased. The howls of Edison's dogs continue to echo today. The evolution of social anxiety. Fear of social situations existed long before the COVID-19 pandemic. Evolutionary models may explain why we developed this trait in the first place. Amidst a year and a half of Zoom fatigue and interactions that feel like plastic replicas of the real thing, the COVID-19 pandemic has made it clear just how important sociality is to our well-being. So it might seem counterintuitive that for many people in the U.S., the return of aspects of a more normal life is also bringing something else, a serious dose of social anxiety. Aaron Tone, a clinical psychologist at Georgia State University, characterizes social anxiety as a set of varied experiences arising from the possibility of a social threat in the environment. Tone says most of us experience social anxiety in tiny doses. In fact, it's considered unusual to never experience it at all during your life. And for a subset of people, these anxious responses seep into everyday social scenarios and can prevent them from doing the things they want or cause extreme distress. At that point, psychologists consider it social anxiety disorder. Regardless of where you fall on the social anxiety spectrum, it's likely that the pandemic has led you to fear some social situations to protect your health. But these anxious responses existed in humans long before the pandemic and will remain long afterwards. Evolutionary theories point to the experience of social anxiety as an evolved adaptation, meaning it arose to increase an individual's chances of surviving and reproducing in their environment. Over the past several decades, two main theories have developed to explain how social anxiety might have offered early humans an advantage. The first is based on competition, which says that social anxiety evolved while our ancestors were living in social structures with clear dominance hierarchies between members. To survive in this kind of environment, socially anxious individuals would have been able to better detect threats of violence or actions that may cost them their own status in the hierarchy. A second theory is based on a model of social exclusion, where social anxiety would have served as a warning signal to the individual that they're at risk of rejection or exclusion, regardless of whether the group existed in a dominance hierarchy. The focus here is on protecting all interpersonal relationships, regulated by a personal sociometer as a gauge for how valued you are in your relationships. But just because social anxiety could have evolved as an adaptive trait to help us survive doesn't mean it functions the same in our modern world. Tone explains that the stakes for survival have changed, but the experience of social anxiety has not, so we're likely over-responding these days. Back in Neanderthal times, Tone says, being ostracized from your group meant it was pretty likely you'd die. Today, that's usually not the case. But we still react as if the stakes are that high, says Tone. Physiologically, I don't think we respond much differently to ostracism if it means we'll be left out in the frozen plane alone, or we'll be left out of the group going out to Starbucks in a few minutes. In 2020, a new evolutionary model of social anxiety emerged that adds a developmental puzzle piece to the mix. Tara Karasiewicz, a PhD student in psychology at Queen's University in Canada, came up with the framework that noticed that the role of an individual's childhood was missing from earlier models. All of our traits evolved in the context of development because all of our ancestors had to grow up and survive, she says. The new model suggests social anxiety evolved to develop during childhood as a conditional adaptation, a type of adaptation that prepares the individual for future conditions. In the case of developing social anxiety, Karasiewicz explains that when your childhood environment is full of social threat cues, it's likely that your future environment is also socially threatening. So developing social anxiety during childhood could make you more prepared to face those challenges as an adult, she says. Sadly, we can't go back in time and verify our evolutionary theories of psychology and behavior with our ancestors. A cautionary example comes from a recent study that called into question a long-standing belief that women in prehistoric societies were only gatherers, never hunters. Given our modern vantage point, says Tone, we need to be careful not to take these theories as truth once we tell them. Sea otters to the rescue. Sea urchins are decimating California's kelp forests, but sea otters have stepped in. The brutal consequences of climate change in California, the record-breaking heat waves, droughts, and wildfires have been well documented, but the climate crisis has also taken a terrible, if more hidden, toll on California's marine ecosystems. Marine heat waves in 2014 and 2015 stressed kelp forests, which need colder water to thrive. They also fueled sea star wasting disease, which began in 2013 and ultimately resulted in the largest marine extinction event in modern history. Untold billions of sea stars, or starfish, from at least 20 species, disappeared from the entire Pacific coast, from Alaska down to Mexico. Enormous sunflower sea stars, now functionally extinct in California, were a major predator for sea urchins. In their absence, the urchin populations exploded. No longer restrained by predation, urchins, a voracious herbivore, moved out of their former rock crevice habitats and laid waste to kelp forests already weakened by high ocean temperatures. Tragically, Northern California has now lost 95% of its once verdant kelp forests. Where these richly biodiverse marine ecosystems once thrived, little more now remains than a seafloor carpeted with spiky urchins, dubbed urchin barrens. The precipitous decline of kelp forests not only dealt a devastating blow to marine biodiversity, but it also had dire economic consequences for the coastal communities that formerly depended on fish, abalone, and other marine resources the forest generated. Kelp forests, which can be up to 20 times more efficient at sequestering carbon than land forests, are also a very important ally in the fight against global warming. However, the situation is complex. While nearly all California's coastal systems have been disrupted by warming waters and massive sea star die-offs, not all kelp forests have declined equally. Central California's kelp ecosystems have fared somewhat better than those in Northern California. A new study led by Joshua Smith, an ecologist at the University of California, Santa Cruz, examines the role robust sea otter populations, a keystone species and a natural predator for urchins, play in preserving existing kelp forests in Monterey Bay. The research project spanned 3 years, during which intensive underwater studies produced some very interesting data about sea otter behavior. Sea otters have very high metabolisms that keep them warm in icy waters, and which also make them ravenous consumers of shellfish, urchin, and fish. Sea otters can eat 25% of their body weight in food a day. At the observed sites, as the urchin population grew, the otter's diet shifted to become more heavily reliant on urchins. In fact, the otters were eating three times as many urchins as they had before 2014. As a result, they provided crucial protection from urchins to the remnant kelp forests. The fact that otters were able to contribute to the health of the patchwork of surviving kelp forests by keeping urchin populations in check provides Smith with hope for the forest's continued survival. The important thing is that the urchins and the patches of barrens are ultimately reduced, he says. The sea otters have maintained patches of kelp forests that can help replenish the barren areas to enhance the recovery of forests. Topsy-turvy on TikTok. It's not you, it's your brain. The inverted filter on TikTok flips the mirror image we're used to seeing in our front-facing cameras, and it's not helping anyone's self-esteem. If you think you always look better in the mirror than you do in photos, one of the latest TikTok trends probably won't make you feel any better. The trend uses the app's inverted filter to flip your smartphone's front-facing camera and by extension, flip that same image you're used to seeing every morning. For most, the phenomenon has proven a surefire way to kick confidence levels down a notch. But why does it feel like you're looking at a less attractive stranger when you see a non-reflected version of yourself? When you're looking at a mirror, you are actually looking at a flipped image. The inverted filter presents you with an unflipped image of yourself, or the version that everyone else sees. As a result, inverted pictures or videos can feel like a completely different version of our faces. Part of this is because our faces are not symmetrical. While the two halves of your face may not look too different, at first, seeing a head-on image of yourself feels unnerving because your features might not line up the way you're used to seeing them. Plus, the app's ability to rapidly toggle between flipped and unflipped images shines a light on these asymmetries. And according to the mirror exposure hypothesis, people prefer what they see and encounter most often. When it comes to our self-perception, this means that we prefer our mirror images instead of our true images, or our reflection as opposed to what others see. This aligns with the findings of a study conducted at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1977, when people were presented with photos of their true image and their mirror image, they preferred the latter. Perhaps less surprisingly, their friends and romantic partners preferred their true image. When participants were asked to explain their preference, they even pointed out differences between the photos, like hair length and head tilt, that didn't actually exist because the photos were made from the same negative. Even if the new filter makes you cringe, take comfort. Everyone else is already used to seeing you that way and actually likes that version more. Starburst. A funfetti-like bloom called Cassiopeia A shows the aftermath of a supernova, or a massive star explosion, about 11,000 light-years from Earth. The vibrant colors added to the image denote the elements detected within it. For example, the blue blobs are titanium, iron is orange, and oxygen is purple. While astronomers aren't certain how some giant stars explode, Cassiopeia A is providing some clues. Using nearly two decades' worth of data from NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory, scientists discovered bubbles of titanium, the same element used to make your electronics and jewelry, that could have boosted the boom's shockwave. Test your statistics skills. Imagine we're throwing a five-sided die 50 times. On average, out of these 50 throws, how many times would this five-sided die show an odd number, 1, 2, or 5? A, 5 out of 50 throws. B, 25 out of 50 throws. C, 30 out of 50 throws. Or D, none of the above. The correct answer is 1, for this question is C, 30 out of 50 throws. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.